Sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Disabilities. The Law Hour is an education source in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on freedom when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this show are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Rule number one in law is this: don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut and then shut up. If you could learn rule one, you could win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Your government is fully capable of making their own case against you without your help. So don't give the prosecutor the victory. At least make him work for it. Listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, or in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge put it this way. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" He said that in a case called U.S. versus Dickerson. The second judge worded it like this. He said, "You can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." That comes from Belknap versus United States. Third judge put it this way. He said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted." And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's the place to start. It's free. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And remember, it's entertaining, educational, informative, and free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc. That's not free, and it's for home education. If you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email. Send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Freedom. Freedom is something that we Americans take for granted. We have been raised with freedom all of our lives, and every American is just as free as a bird. We know that because we learn that in our public schools. And they tell us that constantly. President Bush, every time he gets on the TV, he's talking about freedom, democracy, liberty. He's talking about the American way of life. But I get calls here at the law school constantly from people, and they'll start the conversation by saying, "I'm from the People's Republic of Michigan," or, you know, "I'm from the People's Republic of Florida," or something like that. And they talk about freedoms being eroded, freedoms being taken from us that we used to have that we no longer have. And it's certainly true that it isn't quite the same today as it was 25, 50, or 75 years ago here in the United States. There has been, no doubt about it, a steady erosion of our rights, privileges, and immunities, and the way we exercise our lifestyles today. But a question arises, at least in my mind, is this done because the government came in and put a gun to your head, and by restraint or coercion or by threat or force or of violence, have they taken your rights from you in that way? Or has the government made offers to you and you accepted those offers and you have enslaved yourself by way of your own hand or your own mouth? And I contend that the latter is the modality that we Americans have used to become feudal serfs or slaves. I don't think the word slave is quite correct. Bond servitude is probably the better legal term to use. Americans actually aren't slaves, they're bond servants. But bond servitude is an ancient modality of law that goes clear back to the Mosaic law at Mount Sinai. And a bond servitude is always accomplished by the free will and the consent of the bond servant. Free will and consent. Now, last time we were talking about 15 or 16 indices of slavery or bond servitude, and I pointed out the Russians have a third the number of people incarcerated as we do here in America. And in reality, citizens in America are living in a police state and are completely unaware of it, because there's very little difference between our government and the one in Poland or Russia or China. You know, as an example, I said, do these people that live in what we call police states have national identification cards? Do they need a driver's license to drive? Do they have to get permission to work where they want to? Do they register their guns? Do they register their cars? And do they need government permits and or approval to build on their own land? Here in America, the answer is yes to the first six. We have to do that here in America. I want to point out that there was a time in America when you didn't need a national identification card. You didn't need a driver's license to drive. You didn't need to get permission to work wherever you wanted to or whenever you wanted to. You didn't have to register your gun, and you didn't have to register your car, and you didn't need a government permit to build a building on your land. That's the first six. We do today, and we take it for granted. We all know that that's the way it works. I'm not sure that the average Joe Sixpack knows how it got to be that way, but we all know that that's the way it is today. Let's take a look at number seven. Do you have compulsory insurance laws where you live? Does the government require that you buy insurance of one type or another, as Arnold Schwarzenegger is proposing in California? A universal compulsory insurance program in California, health insurance program. Now, we have almost total universal auto insurance programs here in the United States. Well, if government can compel you to buy an auto insurance policy, I guess they could compel you to buy a health insurance policy or any other kind of insurance policy, couldn't they? Number eight, do you have to show your picture papers upon demand? Have you tried to buy an airline ticket lately? Number nine, do you have to take a balloon test, or do you have some kind of a modality or methodology whereby you have to take a urine test, blood test, or a balloon test upon demand by a policeman for alleged drunk driving? Do you have to prove that you're innocent? Number 10, do you have a portion of your worker's paycheck taken without trial or due process? You know, you work for $10 an hour, you work 40 hours, but do you get paid $400 or do you get paid something less than that, taken from you automatically? Number 11, can you be incarcerated without trial in a summary proceeding? Does that happen in America? Every day. Every day. Does that happen in a police state? Every day. Every day. Is America a police state? Well, if number 11 is the standard, or number 10 or 9 or 8 or 7 or 6, those are all indices of what we call police states. Number 12, do you have things called ports of entry that compel you to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties? We do here in America. Right here in Missouri, we have them. They're called way stations on the highways. Number 13, are you subjected to searches on your highway? Does the highway patrolman stop you and search your car? Or can he? How about, can you be arrested arbitrarily and have your fingerprints taken forcibly? And number 15, do you need a trip permit to use your own road? And number 16, do you need permits to cut wood in a national forest? I mean, can you just go out in the woods and cut wood and then take it home and burn it and heat your house? No, we have national forests here in the United States. You've got to have permits to go out there and cut wood in a national forest. We didn't always have to do that. There was a time in America when not a single one of these 16 indices of a police state were present in the United States of America. Most of them weren't present within my lifetime. I mean, I can remember when you didn't need a permit to go cut wood in a national forest. You didn't need a trip permit to use your own road. I can remember that it was back in the 1950s. It was after World War II that they started putting up all these way stations on the highways over here and regulating trucks and so on. There was a big strike up in Humboldt County. I mean, all the logging trucks just pulled over and stopped. They wouldn't run anymore. They worked it out, and pretty soon when they got down to the bottom line, it was the government wins and the truckers lose, but I just thought I'd point out that I can remember a time when they didn't have those. Now, today, these events, these indices are all accepted. You're born into a ready-made society, and you don't see your society as a police state. You know, I don't think the average Russian sees himself living in a police state, or the average Chinese, or the average American, or Canadian, or Australian, or Frenchman, or German. But these liberties, these freedoms that we used to have and no longer have are incidences of police states. Now, whether there's brutality involved along with the police state, such as the KGB or the Gestapo and Auschwitz and Buchenwald and things like that, the brutality typically comes after the police state has been established. And once the police state is established, or the beneficent socialist welfare state, it can get kind of brutal, you know, from time to time. I mean, if you don't comply with the laws, you can get into a lot of trouble. All right, so now that we have established that there are 16 indices here in the United States, when somebody calls me on the phone and they say, I'm from the People's Republic of California, a question arises then, well, are you the proximate cause of your own injury, or has this been imposed upon you against your will and over your objection? So let's take a little look at a thing called insurance. In the Bible, in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, there's a little story in there about a bull. And in this story, this bull, let's suppose you own this bull, and this bull kills somebody on your land. You know, they're over here on your property, and the bull goes out here, knocks this person down and kills them. There's a penalty that's involved here, and it says that if the bull kills somebody, and if I or you had been warned about this bull being mean, then we would take you out and kill you. And it's called a doctrine, and that doctrine in law is called strict liability. It's the doctrine of strict liability. It means you have to be strictly responsible for your actions and the actions of your dogs and cats and bulls and children and everything else around you. And, of course, that poses what we call liability. Liability. Now, nobody wants to be strictly liable for his own actions. I mean, think about it for a minute. You're driving down the highway, and maybe you're drunk or sober, doesn't really make a lot of difference, and you run somebody off the road and kill them. And then the state comes in here and says, well, we want to prosecute you for involuntary manslaughter. Could even be voluntary manslaughter. We're gonna make you pay these damages because we've determined that it's your fault. You're the proximate cause of that person's injury, and therefore we want you to pay. And in order for you to pay, we might have to take your house and sell it. We might have to take your farm or your business and sell it. And then it might impoverish your wife and your children, and it might impoverish you, and it might put you in jail for a term of years, or it might even get you killed, I guess, in some circumstances. And do you want to accept that kind of liability? And the answer is no. Most people do not want to do that. And that's why we buy insurance. Now, in this country, it used to be voluntary. If you took a look at the hazard, the potential liability, and you said to yourself, well, I don't want to be liable for that, so I think I'll buy this auto insurance policy. Pretty soon, the auto insurance industry came along and they said, well, gee, wouldn't it be real keen if we could get more people to buy auto insurance policies, because then when these accidents occur, more people would be insured and the insurance company would come out and pay those damages, and then it would be good for everybody. It would be good for the injured person, because the injured person would have a source of revenue or funds in a pool that he could rely upon to pay him for his losses. And the guy that caused the damages over here, he would benefit, because now we wouldn't take his farm, his ranch, his home, his business, and he would be better off. Everybody would be better off with insurance. That was the conclusion that we came to. And so here in Missouri, we came up with a scheme in 1976. It was called the Compulsory Auto Insurance Act of 1976. It was actually worded a little different. It's worded like this. It says, it's the Financial Responsibility Act of 1976. Financial Responsibility Act. Compulsory Insurance Act versus Financial Responsibility Act have a lot of meaning to them. Think about it. Do we want to tell people that this act is compulsory, that it's something that we require you to do against your will and over your objection? Or do we want to dress it up a little better, and we call this the Financial Responsibility Act? Well, one day I was driving down the highway. It was back about 1985, I guess, or 86. And Ranger Rick came up behind me, and he stopped me. And he came up and he asked me if I had a driver's license, registration, and insurance. And of course, I didn't answer, and so he arrested me, took me off to jail. And finally, we came up in front of the judge. And this case went to trial. And the judge, the government came in, and they proved their insurance case, and they said, well, we looked in Mr. Gordon's jockey box, and we looked in Mr. Gordon's pockets, and we looked everywhere high and low, and we couldn't find any evidence whatsoever that Mr. Gordon had any insurance. And you see, under this act, they don't have to prove that I don't have insurance. It's up to me to prove that I do have insurance. It's a rin voyai. It's an opposite to what we in America were taught when we went to school, that the accused is presumed to be innocent until he is proven to be guilty. But you see, under these commercial acts, and that's what this is a commercial law, commercial act, we have something a little bit different. The principle of law is that it's a traffic code or regulation, and you have a driver's license, which, of course, I didn't have a driver's license either, so I didn't volunteer into the traffic code or the traffic system, and so there's a little different burden of proof here, but the government, you know, and the government attorney, he proves all of his cases pretty much the same way. He said, well, Gordon didn't produce his insurance card, so therefore he must not have insurance, so therefore he must be guilty. So when the defendant maintains his silence and doesn't answer, the presumption is, well, he must be guilty, because if he was innocent, he would open his mouth and prove that he was innocent, which is the exact opposite from Anglo-Saxon administration. That isn't exactly the way we got that from Moses. So how did the government get this rin voyai put on the books? And the answer is very simple. You sign up for it when you get your driver's license. You sign a contract, and you agree to obey all the laws of the state of Missouri. And some of these laws are traffic laws. And so the burden shifts by your own signature on the application and on your driver's license. The burden shifts from the government has to prove you're guilty to you have to prove you're innocent. That's the way that game is played. All right, let's talk about financial responsibility for a second. Financial responsibility. Of course you want to be financially responsible. After all, it's the responsible thing to do. Everybody wants to be responsible, don't they? I mean, think about it for a second. Did you want to walk out and say, oh no, I'm totally irresponsible. I'm not responsible for my actions. People that aren't responsible for their actions are called legally incompetent. We lock them up in mental hospitals, don't we? So nobody wants to run around saying, well, I'm legally irresponsible. I'm not responsible for my acts. You see, I'm an irresponsible fellow. Nobody wants to do that. It's like being a liar, you know. Do you want to go out and say, well, I'm a liar. I'm a big fat liar, and I don't tell the truth all the time. You know, sometimes I lie. Sometimes I tell the truth. Sometimes I can't tell the difference. So in our society, at least here in America, I can't speak for all the rest of you people around the world, but here in America, you know, people don't want to admit to being financially irresponsible or irresponsible in general. They don't want to admit, you know, that they're liars and that they don't tell the truth all the time. And so we have this kind of a big facade that we run around with. And so when the legislature enacted this law, they didn't call it the Compulsory Insurance Act of 1976. They called it the Financial Responsibility Act of 1976 because everybody wants to be financially responsible. Well, let's think about it for a minute. If you have an insurance policy and you go out and cause somebody a damage, who's responsible for the damage when you have insurance? Isn't it the insurance company? All right. Let's suppose that you don't have insurance and you go out and you cause somebody a damage. Now who's responsible? Absent the contract with the insurance company, it makes you liable and you are responsible. When you're responsible, we call it strict liability. When the insurance company is responsible, we call it limited liability. Limited liability is fairly simple to understand. You pay an insurance premium and then you pay a deductible, and your liability is limited to the premium and the deductible. So let's suppose that you're paying a $500 premium and a $500 deductible and you go out and have a $100,000 wreck. Okay, so we take the $500 principal or premium, you've already paid that, and then we say, okay, now you got to pay the $500 deductible. That's $1,000, and the insurance company will pay the other $99,000. How's that? Assuming you have a $100,000 policy. Now, of course, if you have a $50,000 policy and you cause a $100,000 accident and you have a $1,000 deductible, then they take off $1,000, the insurance company pays $49, and you have a deficiency judgment against you for the other $50. That's the way that works. That's why you want to buy more and more insurance. And insurance agents are happy to seize upon that little foible, and so they tell you right plainly, hey, you're underinsured. You need to have a higher policy limit. But now getting down to financial responsibility, think about it for a second. Who's responsible? The insurance company. Who isn't responsible? You aren't responsible. So this isn't the Financial Responsibility Act of 1976, kids. This is the Financial Irresponsibility Act of 1976. Isn't it? I remember one time I was down at Jake's, had dinner, had a few drinks. My old buddy Colin, he said, Gordon, you're too drunk to drive home. You better call a cab. So I mused about that for a second, and I said, well, you're right about one thing. I am drunk, but it's only 16 blocks from here to home. And if I take a cab home, I got to leave my pickup down here in Jake's parking lot. That poses a problem because tomorrow morning when I get ready to go to work, my pickup is 16 blocks away, which means I got to walk 16 blocks. God forbid that I should walk 16 blocks. I mean, that's preposterous on its face here in America anyway. So that means I got to call a cab again in the morning. And then what likely happens when you call a cab, you got to wait for half an hour before one shows up, you know, irrespective of the $5 or $6 it's going to cost. And I said, I've got an insurance policy. I've got a $500,000 blanket insurance policy that covers one or more accidents. You know, each accident that I get into is covered for $500,000. And I said, I don't think I can cause $500,000 worth of damage in 16 blocks. So I went out and I got my pickup and I drove home. And I was right again. Right again. And that is, I could drive 16 blocks drunk without causing any damage. I'd done it once before, and so I did it again. And there was, I did it twice. And now let me ask you, is that responsible? It isn't responsible on two grounds. First of all, I never was responsible for my actions to start with. The insurance company was. I had bought a limited liability policy because I didn't want to be responsible for $500,000 in damages. I said, that's too much responsibility for little Georgie Gordon to handle. So I've got to have some big brother. I've got to have somebody out here who can insure me, who can pay my damages in the event that I have a big, bad accident. So I bought the insurance called limited liability. Now today, I'm happy to report, I have a little different philosophy in life, and so today I don't have any insurance. Isn't that just special? So now I don't have any insurance. If I go out and cause an accident, then I'm responsible for the damages. I have to pay the damages. All of them. Which is called strict liability. Now remember, I started off this little conversation. I said, we go to Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, and you can go read it for yourself. It's a negligence statute. And God uses this story about a guy who's got a bull, and this bull goes out and he causes some damage, and four or five different ways for this bull to cause damage. And God explains the law concerning negligence. I practice that law now. Instead of practicing insurance, I practice the strict liability statute of Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. It's a wild off-the-wall concept that most people reject. They don't want to do that. Government doesn't want you to do it either. Neither do the insurance company. So it makes it unanimous. The government doesn't want you to practice strict liability. The insurance company doesn't want you to practice strict liability. And you don't want to practice strict liability. The only guy in the equation that wants you to practice strict liability is God Almighty. And what in the hell does he know about negligence law and limited liability? So it's 3-1, and we win, and so we're going to practice limited liability. But in the process of doing that, there are consequences. Consequences come from that. Now remember I said Mel Gibson, you know, at the end of the movie Braveheart, cries out, freedom! Okay, everybody wants freedom. That's a no-brainer. And Americans want to be free, and what they see as being free is, I want to be free to do whatever I want to do to whoever I want to do it to. Whenever I want to do it to them without any responsibility or liability involved. Unfortunately, boys and girls, there's reality out there. And in the real world, when you exercise that freedom, somebody has to be responsible for the consequences that come from those activities. Now, if you want the insurance company to be responsible for your activities on the highway, then the insurance company goes to the legislature and says, we've got to have a seatbelt law, we've got to have a child seat restraint law, and we have to have drunk driving laws. Let's pause right there. You see, from my vantage point in life, I can remember a time when there was no drunk driving laws in America. If you want to drive drunk, drive drunk. The theory behind it was fairly simple. It doesn't make any difference whether you cause the damage drunk or sober. You've got to pay for it. What difference does it make if you're drunk? That's not an excuse. What difference does it make if you're sober? If you cause somebody a damage, you got to pay for it. Well, you know, auto accidents are pretty pricey, and so somebody woke up one day and they said, well, look, I think I'll buy insurance. The insurance industry promptly responded and said, we'll come up with an auto insurance policy. Pretty soon, the auto insurance companies say, well, look, let's get everybody insured. So they go to the legislature and say, we need a compulsory insurance law. The tyranny that you're experiencing comes from your own hand. When you don't want to be responsible and practice strict liability, and you want to practice limited liability, the guy who is going to be liable wants to limit his liability. So the best thing the insurance company can do to limit their liability is to strap you in the car so that when you have an accident, you don't go through the windshield, and that limits their exposure to fixing your face up from the cut glass. If they can keep you in the car, it's pretty common knowledge that fewer people get injured as bad or get killed if they're strapped in the car. So they went to the legislature and said, what we need is a compulsory seatbelt law. Every driver has to have insurance, and then every driver has to buckle his seatbelt, and then every driver has to have a child seat in the back seat to prevent this child from being injured, and so on. And so the insurance company's intent is to collect the premium without paying out any expenses, without paying out any claims. I mean, that's just common sense. Now, you and I ought to exercise that same common sense, keep the premium and the deductible in our own pockets, and drive responsibly. We'd have fewer accidents, and we'd have less money paid out, and everybody would be more responsible. And that's what financial responsibility is all about. It's about who's going to pay the bill. And if the insurance company is going to pay the bill, they're going to go team up with the legislature, and the legislature is going to enact the law, because, you see, the fewer claims the insurance company has, the more profit they make. And the more profit the insurance company makes, then the higher the tax bill on the insurance company, and the more money that the legislators get to spend. I mean, that's just common sense. You don't even have to be real smart. This isn't rocket science. Bottom line is this. Freedom demands responsibility, and without responsibility, tyranny is the result. That's the bottom line. The more irresponsible our society becomes, the more tyrannical it becomes. It's just that simple. The more responsibility that you and I accept and exercise, the freer you and I are going to be. And that's why the scripture calls itself, in James 1:25, the perfect law of liberty. If you want to practice the scripture, you will be practicing strict liability. If you practice strict liability, you're going to be a whole lot more careful than if you have insurance. Now, today, boys and girls, I don't have insurance, and I don't drive drunk. And that's because I am 100% responsible for all of the damages that I cause. Now, that being the case, then I have to exercise a whole lot more self-restraint and a whole lot more individual responsibility than I did when I could blithely say, I've got a $500,000 insurance policy, and I don't believe that I can cause $500,000 damages in 16 blocks. Which now leads us to the midway point in the program, where I have to remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information about that program, please go to our homeschooling page on our website. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give out do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors may be hostile, or they may be political or religious or economic, sectarian, racial or ethnic partisans, whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the law or an editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, though, are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. So for more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I've mentioned to you that the holy grail of law is property and property rights. Rights of and by themselves are properties. If you have a right to vote, then that right to vote is a property right, even though voting of and by itself is a franchise. So you have a right to the privilege. That's what it really boils down to. You have a right to that privilege. Now, privileges are things that can be taken away from you. I explained that to you. When my daddy took my bicycle away from me, if you'd asked me, I'd have said, that's my bicycle. When my daddy grounded me, that meant that was his bicycle, because I belonged to him, and so therefore he could take my bicycle. He could whip me anytime he wanted. He could take anything I had away from me. Governments work in the same way. The government can take your car away from you. They can take your driver's license away from you. They can take your house away from you. In fact, under these executive orders, of which there's now over 12 or 13,000 of them, the government, by fiat, just the president himself, can come in here and seize personal and private property. There is some restraint on that. While the government can take your property in an emergency, say for Hurricane Katrina or something like that, we still have eminent domain. Government has to pay for it at some point in time. Today we're engaged in a war on terror, and of course this invokes the War Powers Act of the Constitution, or the War Powers of the Constitution, invests them in the president. He has some very extraordinary powers. Extraordinary powers. And these extraordinary powers have manifested themselves now in some very bizarre ways that we normally don't experience when we're not at war. And that is, you go to get on an airplane, and you know there's a lot of do's and don'ts, and you got to have your papers in order, and one thing I know. We've been through this before. We went through it in the Civil War, in World War I, World War II, and we're going through it again. Now, some people call it police state tyranny, others call it just a War Powers Act. These are events that transpire, and they impair our liberties to some degree. But by and large, if you stop and think about it, the average American over the last 4 years of war with Iraq and Afghanistan, we haven't really noticed very much. That has changed very much. You know, overall. Yeah, there's some specifics, but overall, nothing's changed very much from the Clinton years or from the Carter years or Reagan years, or you can just go back in time, you know. I'm an old guy now, so I can look back over these various presidencies and one thing and another. I can't really tell a whole lot of difference between the 1950s and today. But slowly but surely, over this long period of time, there have been a lot of erosions on our freedoms to act and so on. I mean, you still had to have a driver's license in 1955. It's just that in 1955, if you didn't have a driver's license, they didn't arrest you, seize your automobile, and throw you in jail the way they do today. They were a little more civil about it. They give you a ticket for driving without a license, you know. And then you go in and pay the ticket, or you'd get a license or whatever. And little by little, as time went on, they got more and more strict and more and more. You know, you didn't have to have insurance in 1955. And then one day somebody woke up and said, well, we're going to make that a law. And so then you came up with the Compulsory Insurance Act. And so little by little, you know, there have been some subtle changes made. Now, this insurance is really the bottom line to the erosion of your liberties. If you want to know why you have a police state in America today, it's because of insurance. Without insurance, you would not have this police state. Let me demonstrate. It really doesn't make any difference how these questions are answered. Citizens of any country who are so constrained are not free, but they're living under tyranny. And it matters not whether we have it better than the Poles or the Russians or the Chinese. Both systems are tyrannical in nature, the only difference being the degree of tyranny being applied and the understanding of the system by its citizens. The Chinese, the Russians, the Poles, and others understand that they live in tyranny, while Americans have been convinced that it can't happen here. Even though it has already come to pass, Americans recognize tyranny in other countries, but in their own country, they refer to it as law and order. Nevertheless, a police state is a police state is a police state is a police state. And there must be a solution that is simple, one that will free us from this morass of crime and punishment. Any solution must conform to our Constitution, quit punishing the innocent, and return to punishing the guilty. The current situation does nothing more than spawn a system of recidivism, homosexual behavior, and prisons that are in reality schools for crime, not rehabilitation centers. Presently, victims lose their property, criminals never make restitution to the damaged party, but are deprived of their freedom, and the taxpayers are fleeced out of their tax dollars to fund these human warehouses that we call prisons. The beneficiaries of this system are called public defenders, lawyers, judges, jailers, prison guards, law enforcement agencies, and the political administrations. These institutions literally thrive off of this morass of crime and punishment. Crime does pay, and crime pays very handsomely. What is worse is that not only does the victim lose by having his property taken, but he loses even more taxes to the law enforcement growth industry to warehouse the thief. Solutions to the crime problem must have restitution to the victim, punish the wrongdoer, decrease the prison population, cut out the overcrowding of those prisons which cannot be emptied, eliminate involuntary capital punishment, make the judicial system self-supporting, and make the entire taxing cost for today's criminal justice system reimbursed by productive accomplishment instead of the incredible waste of manpower presently taking place in these human warehouses that we call prisons. How many broken homes, how many welfare payments, divorces, fines, jail terms, and broken lives are inflicted upon the innocent, the poor, and the defenseless in the name of law and order for the benefit of the law enforcement growth industry? How many people derive their livelihood from the law enforcement growth industry? Have you ever thought of that? How many agencies of government are created by state legislatures, city councils, and Congress just to deal with crime? Take the state of Idaho for an example. It would probably be conservative to estimate that there are over 2,500 persons employed in the law enforcement growth industry in Idaho. May sound like a lot, but consider the following. Idaho has less than 1 million people, and there must be more than 100 policemen just in the city of Boise. I can tell you that in 1960 or 1984, they had 168 policemen. That's what Chief Montgomery told me. Now, there must be 50-plus cities in the state which maintain a city police department and then employ from 3 to 100-plus persons. Now, there are 44 counties in the state, all employing a sheriff, sheriff's deputies, and support personnel numbering from 5 to 100-plus persons. The state police employs several hundred officers and support personnel. In addition, the state employs many varied special agencies. And then we have to consider the administrative agencies which bring actions against citizens, such as the building department, electrical department, health, fire, welfare, plumbing, all those light departments. And there's no way to estimate the number of federal agents swarming over the state because there's OSHA, the EPA, the Federal Communications Commission, the Bureau of Land Management, and many, many more. Then there are the jail and prison staffs and their supporting personnel. Then we have the judicial system at the county, the state, and the federal levels with all of their marshals and bailiffs and secretaries and all of the people that support the criminal justice system in the courthouse. And then finally, there's the lawyer workforce. Now, it should become quite clear that we have no idea how many persons are employed by the law enforcement growth industry, but each and every one of these people is looking for crime. They're looking for lawbreakers. They want to apprehend somebody and then punish that somebody in order to justify their employment. The building inspector is looking for building violations, and the fire marshal is looking for fire violations, and welfare lady is looking for welfare cheats and violations. Everybody in the law enforcement growth industry is looking for crime, criminals, somebody that they can apprehend, bring to justice, prosecute, punish, and put in jail. It seems as though it's the purpose of government to build a system of law and order, a system that is so big that everyone will either be employed by the law enforcement agencies or they will be warehoused in the law enforcement agencies' prisons. And it would further appear that the citizens are simply being used by government to further that end. Now, the law enforcement growth industry is nothing more than a business. It's a business made up of law enforcement agencies, and the customer, the people of the state, they are in a relationship with these governmental agencies. And like any business, this industry needs more and more customers to continue to grow and prosper. In order to justify its existence and to justify its size to the people, and in order to obtain more funds to further the growth of these law enforcement agencies, the growth cycle goes something like this. First of all, we're told that we ought to have and that we need more laws. Second, the executive proposes some new statutes to the legislature. And third, the legislature passes those statutes and creates a criminal act where no criminal act existed before. Fourth, the executive branch has more status, more statutes to enforce, and therefore it needs more employees to enforce more of those statutes. Fifth, the executive appeals to the legislature or to the city or county commissioners or city councils, that they need more funds due to the increasing crime rate, which is caused by more legislated crimes. Now the funds are made available, and more employees are hired by these governmental agencies. More employees have to justify their existence, and therefore government must find or entrap more and more customers, more and more citizens into committing more and more of these so-called crimes. Which now means in order to control more and more of these so-called crimes, now we need another law. Let me explain it this way. Chief Montgomery went down to the city council in Boise, and he said the crime rate here in Boise has gone up by 5%. And so the city council, they all shudder and they go, oh my God, that sends a bad signal to people in California that we're trying to attract to come to Idaho to bring their money, to build their houses, to move their businesses, to improve our economy. Because who the hell wants to move to a crime-infested area? And that's why people are leaving California, because of the crime. And so the chief of police proposes to the city council that the reason that we're having more and more crime is because we don't have enough money and enough policemen with enough police cars to go out there and enforce the laws so that we can bring the crime rate down. That makes a lot of sense. You know, if there's 168 policemen in Boise and we're enforcing 1,000 laws, that's in a city of about 100,000, at least it was back in the early 80s. And so the chief of police says, now, if you give me 5% more money, I can hire 5% more policemen, put on 5% more patrol cars, and we'll go out there and we'll control that crime. And so the city council says, that sounds logical to us. And so they approved the expenditures and raised your taxes to provide 5% more money. Now, the chief of police says, we also need 5% more laws. So instead of 1,000 laws, we need 1,050 laws. Instead of 168 policemen, we need about 178 policemen. And instead of 100 patrol cars, we need 105 patrol cars. You give me the money and the manpower and give me the tools that I need, these new laws, and watch what I do next. Okay, so now he's got 10 more policemen, he's got more money, more patrol cars, and he's got 5% more laws. 5% more policemen go out and enforce 5% more laws, and they apprehend 5% more criminals. But then, boys and girls, that's what you're paying for. It's what you're buying. You're buying more crime. That's the way you grow your business. I was in the waterbed business. If I wanted to grow my business, and I'm selling $1 million a year, and I want to grow my business by 5%, then I need to raise my sales by 5%. To do that, I need 5% more salesmen. So I take 5% more money, hire 5% more salesmen who go out and talk to 5% more customers and sell 5% more profit or product, and then I increase my sales by 5%. That's all the law enforcement growth industry is doing. So every time your legislature meets and passes 5% more laws, they have to have 5% more policemen to enforce those 5% more laws with 5% more money, which produces 5% more criminals, which means that next year, the law enforcement growth industry comes back and says, oh my God, the crime rate grew 5% last year. So you've got to increase my budget by 5% so I can have 5% more laws, 5% more policemen, 5% more patrol cars. And we're in fact, children, buying 5% more crime because we are increasing and enlarging the law enforcement growth industry, which then goes out and finds more criminals. Now, there was a time when not wearing your seatbelt wasn't a crime. There was a time when driving drunk wasn't a crime. There was a time when not buckling your kid into the special seat in the back wasn't a crime. But when you enacted those laws, you made those crimes. Now the policeman has more laws to enforce. So when the policeman stops, he starts up, got a license, registration, proof of insurance, an inspection sticker, wearing your seatbelts, got your kid buckled in. That's 7 items right there off the top. Have you got an open container in the car? Have you got a gun sitting on the seat? I mean, all of these laws that weren't laws 100 years ago are now laws today for which you can go to jail, be fined, be arrested, be punished. And every time there's a new law, kids, there's a restriction upon your liberty, a restriction upon your freedom. Every time a new law is passed, there's one more area of your life that government controls. One more area of your life that you have less freedom, less liberty to exercise. Now, there was a time when you decided whether you should buckle your seatbelt. Nobody leaves it to you to decide. You are obviously irresponsible and incapable of making that decision. That's been made for you by the legislature, and it's being enforced by the policeman. So don't get mad at the policeman now. He's just doing his job. His job is to enforce these 2,000 traffic laws. That's what he's hired for. And don't get mad about the number of policemen out there on the roads, because after all, when it's reported to you and when you go to the polls to vote and some guy comes up and says, I'm the law enforcement, I am the law and order candidate, vote for me and I will give you more laws, more policemen. President Clinton said, I'll put 100,000 more policemen on the streets of America. Well, those 100,000 policemen, on average, are going to arrest somebody every day. That's 100,000 more arrests every day. And 94% of those arrests are going to be convicted. So 94,000 of those people are going to be convicted. So those 94,000 people then, if they go to jail, have to have beds, and they have to have bars, and they have to have prisons. And that's why you have more people incarcerated in the United States than you have incarcerated in Russia or China or South Africa. It's because you want more and more law and order. And the more law and order that you buy, the more people you're going to incarcerate. Therefore, the more people you're going to have to support in those jails. The more policemen you're going to have to hire. The more judges you're going to need. The more lawyers. The more secretaries and support staff and guards to guard them all. In short, You have to get up in the morning and go out and vote and buy all of this law enforcement growth industry. You don't have this being imposed upon you, boys and girls. You're going out here and actively buying it, supporting it. You want it. You desire it. You demand it. And any politician that won't give you what you want is soft on crime, and we're going to vote him out. Boys and girls, we Americans have put an iron collar around our necks with the law enforcement growth industry. So we pass more laws and hire more police and investigators and prosecutors and judges, and we spend more money only to learn the next year that crime has risen by 5%, and we need to combat this increase in crime with more money, more laws, more police, more prosecutors, and more judges. It's been that way for years. And it could be argued that there was a year when, in one or two categories, crime declined in Boise or Pocatello or East Podunk, USA. And that's either a foible in the charts or a goof-up by the industry and falling down on their job and not selling enough product. Headlines do not exist stating Idaho's prison population declines for the fifth consecutive year, or the sheriff submits his third successive budget with a 5% reduction in requests. We have been spending more money every year for law enforcement, and since we spend more on crime and the crime industry, we get what we pay for. We get more crime. As an example of the problem, let's just take a look at City X, and let's assume that City X has 100 policemen, and today the crime rate is up 5% over last year. So the media are told that the reason 100 policemen couldn't hold crime in the same level as the year before is that the police force is understaffed and underbudgeted, and there are some deficits and defects in the existing statutes, and therefore we need more money and new laws. And we get more money and more laws and more policemen and more police cars, and we get more crime, and the crime rate grows by 5%, and the cycle goes on and on and on and on ad infinitum. Boys and girls, and we're getting what we pay for. All right, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there, so let me remind you one more time that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.